Greetings and draconian crustaceans, my guittertetically Harvellian listeners, and welcome to this June 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this utterly punctilious science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. All right, let's just start with the idiot scientist of the month, since that seems to be the most popular thing I talk about now from month to month. So, we're going to go back in time tonight. I came across this marvelous article in the online journal OZY, O-Z-Y, by Sam Braswell. Braswell tells the amazing story of a 19th century idiot and forerunner to Harvey Weinstein et al. By the name of Francis Galton. Now, Galton, you may have heard of before because he was the father of eugenics. And, well, we should just take a couple points off for that, and add a couple because he was the cousin of Charles Darwin. Galton attended Cambridge University, from which he embarked on a full life of science, discovery, and hedonism, punctuated by remarkable insights and the occasional nervous breakdown, according to author Braswell. Galton is considered to have been a genius, though a seriously messed up one. He was best known for his theories of inheritance, human genetics, and selective breeding. He applied his knowledge of math and science to a wide variety of endeavors, from fingerprinting and the efficacy of prayer to his investigations into such British concerns as weather forecasting and how to brew the perfect cup of tea. More than anything, Galton loved measuring things, and he helped found the field of statistics because of that. And by the time that Galton hit middle age, he took to the streets of Britain to conduct a very unusual experiment that several former U.S. presidents, as well as the present one, would have probably appreciated. That's a very sad statement. Anyway, wearing a homemade device he kept in his pocket called his pricker, composed of a needle and paper affixed to the finger and palm of a work glove, Galton toured the country, obtaining data for what would become his beauty map of the British Isles. Galton did this by surreptitiously poking holes in three different sections of a piece of paper that he had labeled. As he would put it in his 1908 memoirs, he would tell whether the girls I passed in the streets or elsewhere were, quote, attractive, indifferent, or repellent, unquote. It was not the first time Galton had blended science and being a perv. As a young man in Africa, he had used a sextant to measure the dimensions of a busty native woman he described as a, quote, Venus among the Hottentots, unquote. Also, while staying in France, he had developed a classification system for the women he encountered, grouping them into six sizes, from thin to prize fat. Galton used the data he obtained from his pricker to map the attractiveness of Britain's female inhabitants, and he stated in the end, I found London to rank highest for beauty, and Aberdeen, Scotland, to be the lowest. In a letter to the journal Nature in 1879, entitled The Average Flush of Excitement, Galton recounts a visit to the Derby. And he noted that while he was there, he was able to assess what he called the average tint of the complexion of the British upper classes by observing distant crowds through an opera glass. He observed that after the race started, the crowd became, quote, suffused with a strong pink tint, just as though a sunset glow had fallen upon it, unquote. Galton thought he could work out the mood of a mass of people, even without even being able to distinguish one person from the next, just based on the general pinkness of the crowd. At his death, he left the enormous sum of £45,000 to found the Laboratory of National Eugenics at University College of London. That term of eugenics was soon abandoned, although University College of London still has a Galton professorship. I suspect this was probably heard at the Darwin residence at least once.
Charles, tell your idiot cousin Frank when you see him at the Royal Academy that his mother called and is concerned about the state of his soul.
First story of the night. For you younglings out there, well, relative younglings, you need to start thinking of your colon at a younger age, apparently. There are now new guidelines from the American Cancer Society that were suggested on May 30th that colorectal cancer screening should begin at the age of 45 rather than 50. Why? Well, because colon cancer seems to be getting worse and not better in younger people. Essentially, the recommendation is a response to the steady rise over several decades in the colorectal cancer rate in younger Americans. For people at average risk for colorectal cancer, that is, those without a personal or family history of the disease, and who haven't had inflammatory bowel disease, the American Cancer Society suggests regular screening begin at age 45, with either stool-based tests or visual exams, like a colonoscopy. The new guidelines were published a month ago or so in the journal CA, Cancer Journal for Clinicians. And the work was done by Dr. Andrew Wolf of the University of Virginia's School of Medicine and his research group. Colorectal cancer is the second most common cause of cancer death in the U.S. Lifestyle choices like smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, not exercising, eating processed foods and red meat, and not eating fruits and vegetables can increase a person's risk for the disease. The American Cancer Society says that screening can catch precancerous polyps and early-stage cancers when they may be more easily treatable. Wolf says, quote, overall rates of colorectal cancer have declined by more than 45% since the 1980s, owing in part to screening. In sharp contrast, the rates of colorectal cancer have been increasing among all age groups between the ages of 20 and 49. Those ages have experienced a 51% rise in the incidence of colorectal cancer since 1994, unquote. Wolf and company aren't quite sure why the disease is increasing among younger Americans, but Wolf adds that, quote, it's not just relative to the older groups. The absolute case numbers are going up in the younger group, too. The increase we are seeing is not simply a reflection of the drop in the cancer among older groups who are being screened, unquote. So the next story of the evening is Nature's highlight of the month for May. This is actually molecular biology, which is my bailiwick, and I thought it was so cool. So I spent weeks talking to my molecular biology classes about how genes are regulated. In complex cells like we have, called eukaryotic cells, it can get quite complicated how a gene is turned on and off and then regulated. There are a whole series of levels of control from the point before the messenger RNA transcription has even started to a whole slew of regulatory systems that are in effect after the protein is made. Bacterial genes are seldom that closely regulated. And I try to explain to my students that complex cells are regulated more closely because of developmental programs. Bacteria live from moment to moment, and they pretty much respond to the environment from moment to moment. Genes are turned on as they're needed, then turned off as they're needed. Eukaryotic cells need to worry about regulation in time and space. If genes are not turned on and off at the proper time, in the proper place, for the proper length of time and in the proper sequence, then you may not have a brain or a heart or a liver or a hand developing for you. It becomes very complex. This story has to do with a new way of controlling protein production by actually making mistakes and bashing organelles together. Ribosomes are the organelles that read messenger RNA and translate that information into proteins. It turns out that random malfunctions of the ribosomes help regulate protein synthesis, according to new research. Dr. Pavel Baranov and fellow researchers at University College of Cork observed that ribosomes occasionally misread the final mRNA instruction in the AMD1 gene. And rather than stopping, ribosomes sometimes just continue until reaching a second stop signal further down the mRNA. Malfunctioning ribosomes then run into the stalled ribosomes ahead of them, piling up in a queue, sort of like train cars running into one another. And the idea is pretty amazing. Eventually, that queue of ribosomes attached to the mRNA covers the end of the gene and prevents the new incoming ribosomes from accessing it, and this blocks further protein production. The rate of translation and the number of protein molecules produced depends on the rate at which stalled ribosomes disengage and come loose off the mRNA, as well as the distance between the two stop signals that are in the mRNA. The other cool thing that Baranov's team found was that the genetic signatures of this mechanism are detectable in over 80 vertebrate species, that is, animal species with a spine. That means that the regulatory process of piling ribosomes into each other as a regulatory system is widely conserved and probably dates back for millions of years. Onwards and upwards. You may have heard this recently in the popular news. Dr. Paul O'Connor and researchers from the Medical College of Georgia have evidence that a daily dose of baking soda may help the spleen to promote an anti-inflammatory environment. This could be therapeutic to the inflammation caused by autoimmune diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis. The results published last month in the Journal of Immunology suggest that baking soda could be a safe and easy way to treat autoimmune diseases in the future. O'Connor orally administered baking soda solution to rats and observed the responses of their organs. The baking soda triggered the stomach to generate more acid, as if anticipating a meal, but also stimulated the mesothelial cells of the spleen. The mesothelial cells line body cavities and the outside of organs like the stomach and the spleen, and the cells have microvilli that sense the environment and respond to invading organisms by signaling their organs' immune response systems. This includes the release of specialized cells called macrophages from the spleen. Macrophages basically are sort of hunter cells that look around the entire body and all the tissues to look for invaders, and then they engulf them once they find them. O'Connor says, quote, "We believe that when the baking soda is ingested, the signaling from the mesothelial cells tells the spleen to temper its immune response. This transmission of message is helped along by the signaling protein acetylcholine," unquote. So once the message is received by the spleen, it begins to produce more anti-inflammatory macrophages, as opposed to the aggressive inflammatory M1 type cells that are made by the immune system. The anti-inflammatory immune response may be induced from consuming baking soda, leading to a response from the spleen. O'Connor also says, quote, "We think that the acetylcholine signals that we know mediate this anti-inflammatory response are not coming directly from the vagal nerve innervating the spleen, but from the mesothelial cells that form the connections to the spleen," unquote. O'Connor confirmed this thinking when he found that damaging the vagal nerve caused no disruption to the mesothelial cell behavior. However, when the spleen itself was touched, removed, or moved, the anti-inflammatory response was lost due to damage to the connections of the mesothelial cells. O'Connor finishes with, quote, "You are not really turning anything off or on. You're just pushing it toward one side by giving anti-inflammatory stimulus. It's potentially a really safe way to treat inflammatory disease," unquote. So the next story also comes from the journal Nature last month, from the lab of Dr. V.D. Burkert of the Thomas Jefferson National Accelerator Facility. Since we are all SF aficionados to one degree or another, we have all heard of neutron stars and know just how dense the material is there. We've all heard that even a couple of cc's of neutronium could weigh tons. Now imagine a place where even greater pressure than that is occurring. And no, not in a black hole. We're talking about every molecule in your body, every atom, in fact. Burkert's new study finds that protons are under a lot of pressure. Proton innards are squeezed harder than any other substance ever measured. Burkert says, quote, "It's really the highest pressure we have ever seen. Protons break the pressure record set by neutron stars, those incredibly dense, dead stars that can form when a massive star explodes and its core collapses, squeezing more mass than the sun's into a remnant the size of a city," unquote. Burkert's research group reports that the pressure in the proton's center averages a million trillion trillion times the strength of Earth's atmospheric pressure. That's around 10 times more pressure than found inside of a neutron star. Previously, scientists had theoretically predicted that such pressures might occur inside protons, but the new result is the first experimental proton pressure gauge. I guess that in proton research, the particle's internal pressure distribution has been a largely unexplored frontier. Even though pressure is one of the proton's fundamental properties, no one's really studied it. So I've been told by physics friends that protons are made up of smaller particles, including quarks, which are electrically charged, and gluons, which transmit the strong nuclear force that holds protons together. In the center of this ball of particles, Burkert and his colleagues report an intense pressure outward. But this record-breaking outward force is kept in check by an internal pressure from the outer regions of the particle. Burkert finishes with, quote, "This pressure pattern parallels what happens in much larger objects, and in some sense, it's like looking at a star. Stars also have pressures that push outward in their centers, which counteract the inward pull of gravity. Protons are held together by the strong force, just as stars are held together by gravity. But the tiny protons are a different beast, so it's natural, but it's not completely trivial, that the two objects would have similarities pressure-wise." Unquote. Last story of the night. Riddle me this, dynamic duo. When are breast milk, vitamin D, and the shape of your teeth related? Well, the answer is when you're a Native American. So this story starts anywhere between 18,000 and 28,000 years ago, as the last glacial maximum, or the last ice age, set in. And as temperatures and productivity dipped, a portion of the human population migrated to a region between Asia and North America called Beringia, where they remained isolated for about 10,000 years. That was before dispersing into the New World. When they actually did disperse, that population became the Native Americans. Now, nearly all Native Americans have quote-unquote shovel-shaped incisors. The origin of this trait has piqued the curiosity of researchers for a long time. It was proposed that selection for this trait happened sometime during the last ice age, when the Native American population was geographically isolated to Beringia. This trait arises due to mutations in the EDAR gene, which codes for ectodysplasin A receptor. This receptor, this protein, controls the density of sweat glands, the thickness of hair shafts, and the branching of ducts in the mammary glands.
and it also controls the shape of your teeth. It was originally thought by scientists that this mutation arose due to selection for more sweat glands, and shovel teeth were kind of co-selected as the same gene controlled tooth shape and sweat glands. However, Dr. Leslie J. Haluska of UC Berkeley and her colleagues stated in a recent study in PNAS that they were not convinced that sweat glands were the answer. In latitudes above 48 degrees, where the Beringia population was isolated, there are almost no UVB levels. UVB exposure is critical for the biosynthesis of vitamin D, which regulates calcium absorption. It also regulates the immune system and whether you're going to get autoimmune diseases or not. So in these regions, the diet has to be fortified with vitamin D-rich foods. Although diet can supplement older children and adults and get them more vitamin D, having so little vitamin D in their mother's bodies puts breastfeeding children at a greater risk for vitamin D deficiency. Interestingly, the gene that causes shovel teeth also increases the branching of mammary ducts. It's known that vitamin D from mothers can be transferred to breast milk, and the study suggests that children in low UVB conditions would be particularly dependent on breast milk from mothers for their source of vitamin D. Haluska's study proposes that a mutation in the EDAR gene was selected during the Ice Age in the Native American population to influence milk content. This was to increase the vitamin D levels in breastfeeding children to counteract the low levels of UVB-induced vitamin D production. So, the tooth shape in Native Americans that initiated the curiosity of the researchers was simply a side effect. Ta-da! This story just shows how little we understand sometimes about how the environment and gene expression and evolution are really connected. That's all for me for now. As always, take care. Consider bicarbonate if your old bones be aching. If you think you're under pressure, think of those poor protons. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.